Hello and welcome to a special edition of Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons and I'm joined by Guardian critic Zan Brooks, and we attempt to sum up the year with our top 10 countdown of film releases from 2009. So if Santa Claus has let you down this year and all you got was another pair of socks, we might be able to put your holiday back on track with our wonderful Film Weekly competition. We have a Le Duncan Scorsese bumper pack to give away, including a signed poster by Shane Meadows, a handsome poster it is too. With that autograph on it, it ought to be worth a fortune in years to come. So, without further fuss, let's roll out our top 10 films of 2009. Zan, 2009, a vintage year or not?
It's quite weird, isn't it? Because when you actually sit down and write our top 10s, as we have done this week, you think, yeah, that's a vintage year. It looks really good.
I mean, you look at that list of your 10 and my 10, and you think, oh, God, yeah, I'd see all of those films again, sort of, in a way. I mean, I'd happily program them for a mate if he was coming around and say, sit down, watch these, you won't be disappointed.
Absolutely. But, of course, as regular listeners will know, we've also had to sit through endless, endless garbage, too.
Would you say that there's anything that defines the year when you look at the top 10 or 20 that you assemble? Is there a trend that happens in 2009?
Well, the only thing that strikes me looking at my list, and I guess yours as well to a certain degree, is that there are sort of great films, but they're smaller scale films. Mm. They're almost films about the domestic sphere a lot of the time. They're saying big things, but on a small canvas. And if we've missed anything this year, I think we've missed big films on a big canvas that dare to say something about the world that we're in. I was thinking this time last year, you know, I was talking about Waltz with Bashir and maybe There Will Be Blood and films like that. There's maybe been a lack of those, I think.
Yeah, there's also been a lack, I suppose some may say this is a good thing, and I think it's probably a trend of films of the decade, is that Hollywood has kind of not really stepped up to the mark.
Yeah, it's dropped the ball, to choose another metaphor, I think. I think that's certainly true, that it's been a bad year for Hollywood. Not a bad year maybe in commercial terms, but, you know, but they've had Transformers and Terminator and all the usual
I mean, it's been a decade of sequels and cartoons and franchises, and that sort of left them without saying anything. I mean, they've done all right, bums on seats.
They've been fine. They don't care because they're getting the bums on seats. But in terms of actually setting an agenda and leading the art form as opposed to the industry, I think that they're negligent.
Yeah, and they're making a big fuss about Avatar at the moment, which may, you know, well feature on some people's end of year listening to the Oscar Academy. But that's a format thing, isn't it? It's not really changed the way we see the world. It's not really changed the way we've seen humanity or narrative or storytelling in a way.
Not at all. And of course, there's a danger that people listen to this and think, oh, you're just sniffy critics and you'd never go for a Hollywood film anyway.
No, I would love
to. And I don't think that's true.
No, I would absolutely love. I mean, I think there's nothing so good as a brilliant Hollywood film.
Yeah.
I think it's probably the best thing there is.
But
unfortunately, they're not making them.
They're not there this year.
All right, Zan, let's crack on with what has garnered our attention. You're going to give me your top 10. I'm going to give you my top 10. We'll see where they cross over. We'll argue the toss and we'll see what comes out on top. So, Zan, let's crack on. Can I get you to give me your number 10 choice of 2009, please?
Number 10 on my list, literally, I think, with a bullet, is The Hurt Locker by Catherine Bigelow. This is her film about the war in Iraq, or the end game of the war in Iraq, focusing on a bomb disposal team on the mean streets of Baghdad.
We'll come back to it when we get to it on my list, because the way we do this is that if it's higher on someone's list, we'll defer to the higher number as well. So
okay,
we'll come back to Hurt Locker
to
as we must. My number 10 is Red Cliff, which is not the sequel to Red Ken and his reign as mayor of London. It is John Woo's depiction of a very famous battle in China, sort of a battle of Hastings. Everyone in China knows this battle. And here's a clip from Red Cliff. Now, you probably didn't know what was going on there, Zan. But that was Guan Gong escaping from Guan Yu. I love this. This was John Woo going back to China. The reason I put it in there is because in terms of the blockbusters, which I thought were, you know, just terminally disappointing, here was one that was made by someone who'd been in Hollywood and yet brought that sensibility back to the big Chinese thing. And it was just huge. I mean, this landscape, it was just full of arrows, innovative battle scenes, kind of naff CGI, but I liked it. And it kind of swept me away with its kind of, you know, ballet of action and kind of blood. And then it was also about the importance of making a good cup of tea and how things can hinge on that, beautiful temptresses and princesses. I thought it was full of, you know, it always had this kind of Homeric beauty to it. And I mean, I absolutely thought this was the blockbuster of the year. I don't think it busted any blocks except in China. No one really.
But this is maybe an interesting point to make, that if Hollywood has dropped the ball, as we're saying, the industry is shifting. the Hollywood is desperately trying to invest in the East, in Asia, in India, trying to tap into the Bollywood market. And there's a sense that maybe this is now the natural home of the blockbuster. And the blockbusters that you're going to get coming out of these countries are going to have a different tenor and a different tone to Western blockbusters. And you're right, this was a great bridgehead of that. This was a great pioneering Eastern blockbuster.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've depicted the future here in looking at the past.
I think you're right.
Well, that's brilliant, we are. Well done, Zan. Number nine from you, please.
Number nine for me is Adventureland, a coming-of-age comedy from Greg Mottola.
So Lisa P just asked me if I wanted to go out with her sometime.
Lisa P?
Yeah. It's insane. I think she might have just been trying to piss off Pete O'Malley, but...
So this is Adventureland by Greg Mottola, who of course directed Superbad. This is, again, a coming-of-age comedy, but it's slightly less scatological, slightly less noisy, slightly less boisterous. I think part of the reason why I loved it is that it gave me a great hit of nostalgia. It's set in the 1980s, and it's Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart as two teenagers who are kind of drifting. They should be going to college, but instead they're working at this deadbeat amusement park. And it did capture, I never grew up in Pittsburgh, but it did capture the agonies of those interim years.
Because he's a bit, what I like about Jesse Eisenberg, he's a sort of an intellectual, he likes to read kind of literature, and she's the kind of slightly indie girl as well, yeah. And they feel adrift in this world of kind of shallowness.
Yes.
Even though, you know, they're clearly slightly stupid themselves, which is what I like about it.
Well, it captures the uncertainties of it, the sort of the sexual longing, the late night drives in kind of beat up cars when you've got really no place to go, and it's got a great soundtrack from that time as well, which was basically the soundtrack that I was playing at that time.
Huskadoo,
Velvet Underground, The Replacements, and the sense that this music is transformative and that there's a world that's out there. It's not the world that you're living in because you're working in this shitty amusement park, but there's a sense that through the music you can maybe escape to the world that you want to be.
Yeah, I like Ryan Reynolds in this movie. He plays the guy who may or may not
have jammed with Lou Reed, but was obviously lying.
Completely made it up. But everyone's like, oh my God. Kristen Stewart, a great year for her. Obviously, she starred in New Moon. I think she's a terrific actress, and
she's
you get
great.
To see more of her in this.
Yeah, you do. This is a good role for her. She's basically this sexy but damaged, screwed up kid who's acting old before her time.
That's your number nine, Adventureland by Greg Mottola. My number nine, Zan, is a reissue. I've slightly cheated here, but I thought it was such a great reissue. Great to see it back on the big screen. It formed part of the Joseph Losey season at BFI South Bank. It is Accident.
There was an accident. We were all in it. Anna, Charlie, William, Rosalind, the kids and I.
A brilliant 60s amalgam of kind of the avant-garde with the very British class system as well, with great score by Johnny Dankworth. I mean, I loved seeing this. I had to confess that I'd never seen this film before until it was put on me the big screen, and I thought it was one of the best things I'd seen all year. In fact, if this were a sort of free competition and I could put a reissue at the top, it would become my film of the year.
I think this is a cheat though. You're 40 years behind the curve of this. If we're doing reissues, I'll put The Red Shoes in there.
Yeah,
which
that's
is also
pretty good too. That'll go far. But I just had to. I enjoyed it.
It is a great
so
film. It is a fantastic film, and in that way that it's dated, but in the best possible way, that it looks strange.
It's wonderful, everyone walking around playing tennis and then going off to have affairs at the BBC in London, and clip vowels. But also it had a sort of seediness to it as well, which I really liked.
Yeah, dankness.
Johnny Dankworthness. That was my number nine. Slight cheat accident, but well worth it. Go on, you can't really have me up for that one. Let's move to number eight, Zan. Your number eight, please.
My number eight is The Wrestler.
Drop like a brick and I don't remember nothing. Well, now the doctors tell me that I can't wrestle no more.
What are you gonna do?
You know,
The Wrestler is Darren Aronofsky's film about a broken down old wrestler, Mickey Rourke, playing the sort of dying animal who is working behind the deli counter. He's got his hearing aid, he's got his Dickie Hart, and he's got the death or glory bout at the end. This is absolute corny stuff. We've seen this 1,000 times before. And yet it's never dishonest. And it's beautifully played. You could say that maybe it's exploiting Rourke's own off-screen travails. This is a man who was at his peak in the 1980s and then has been a car crash ever since. This is a performance that gives the impression of being torn out of his soul. And it is a performance for the ages.
It's a sort of classic of a lo-fi nature.
It is, yeah.
At number eight. At my number eight, I'm going to give you Sugar.
Channel it into working harder. So
I am work hard. Every day I work hard.
Yes, work harder, goddammit. You think you're the only one on this team works hard?
Yo no entiendo lo que tú dices, todo lo muy rápido.
Sugar is a Dominican baseball player in a film by Ryan Fleck and Anna Boden, the people who've previously given us Half Nelson. Here examining the a young baseball hopeful who has to leave the camp that the American leagues have set up in the Caribbean. They have these camps all over the place. So it opened my eyes, kind of documentary, to the way that the American conglomerates and baseball teams have got these little kind of camps hidden away, almost like guerrilla camps. Like you imagine like Che Guevara in another era would have been sitting in an American baseball camp plotting his revenge. It would have been a great way in, but they've got all these people all over the Caribbean, and I think they've got them not just in there, in South America as well, and Japan. They've got these kind of hot houses where they're kind of training youngsters to make it in the big leagues, and that journey from there is so tortuous, you know, coming from that small town into America and then kind of growing up and then finding the dream is not all it's cracked up to be. An injury plays its part. I thought as a sports movie documentary it was just a genius piece of
work. And also an odd companion piece to The Wrestler, which is just the downside or the nuts and bolts world of sport.
So they're both interesting sports movies told through the central figure as well. So for some reason we're in synchronicity on our number eight there, Zan. Let's move up to number seven for you, Zan. We go to Italy for
Il Divo.
Da nessuna parte,
perché la nostra non è una corrente,
è un impero teocratico
dove comanda uno solo.
Il Divo is the biopic, the unofficial, very unofficial biopic of Giulio Andreotti, the three-time Prime Minister of Italy, who is played here by Tony Servillo as a kind of Nosferatu figure. He's a character basically living in corruption and perhaps born out of corruption. It's by Paolo Sorrentino, who did The Consequences of Love. And I think he's maybe one of the great visual directors working in cinema.
Let's face it, you try and sum up the plot here. It's quite a dense film.
I can't sum up the plot.
I really know what's going on there.
There are people, it's all the usual suspects, I guess, of Italian politics, many of whom are bit players and are introduced by crash captions that just suddenly appear on the screen and disappear. And I'm thinking, I've no idea who that person is or that person is. I've no idea, really, what the plot of this film is.
You mentioned Sorrentino there, one of the Italian New Wave darlings. He used Tony Servillo, the actor, in his film The Consequences of Love, and then he did a film called The Family Friend about a sort of hunchback moneylender, which was just visually arresting again. Just give us some idea, for anyone who hasn't seen Il Divo, what Sorrentino does as a director.
He is the master choreographer of the image, I guess. There's an operatic sweep to him. This is very Italian. It's flamboyant. He gives us great tableaus. He's not scared to move the camera around, these long, long tracking shots. He gives us these parties that he leads us into, and as if we're the sort of honoured guest being led through these sort of debauched bacchanalian revels. And it is utterly mesmerizing.
From the glamour of Italian politics and the shadowy kind of nefarious Nosferatu-ness of it all, interestingly, at my number seven, I've got to look at politics too, where you aped me with a sports movie at number eight. At number seven, I'm going to ape you with a very British version of Il Divo. It's In the Loop by Armando Iannucci.
See, if he'd asked you to fucking black up, or to give him your PIN number, or to shit yourself, would you have done that as well?
I would have blacked up, because it was radio, nobody would have known.
Very good, yeah. Well, what is
strange synchronicity there. It is a look at the British political system when it goes to meet America. This is a sort of film version of the TV hit, the thick of it. I think that Peter Capaldi's Malcolm Tucker is one of the great creations. In the way that Tony Servillo is wonderful as Andreotti, this monster, I think Peter Capaldi's Spin Doctor is an equally terrifying monster of British politics, kind of trying and flailing to kind of bend the world to his kind of twisted will. I think this is just a delightful comedy that has some of the most colourful, brilliant writing around.
I think you're right. And it suddenly occurs to me as well that I think that we have the War on Terror covered in this top 10. We've got the Hurt Locker, which is on the ground in Baghdad, and we've got In the Loop, which is the machinations behind going to war. And these machinations don't play out in glamorous environments. They basically play out in crappy little offices with filing cabinets that don't work, where nobody knows quite what's going on or who to be friends with, and everybody's shouting at each other. It's a film that gives the impression of being made in the white hot of creativity, with the real world spilling in as it's being made. And I think as a time period, piece. It's a film that we'll look back on in 30, 40 years' time as the great document of the run-up to the war in Iraq.
Yeah, as British satire goes, I was delighted. It kind of reminded me of Strange Love. It made us very angry. I remember producer Jason Fitz, we went to Dublin to meet Armando at the premiere of In the Loop, and he said, oh, it made me really angry. And everyone was laughing. And Armando said, that's the best compliment anyone's ever paid. That's the idea. There is this burning kind of frustration with the way that politics is so crap. Ha! What we need is movies, Zan, so we'll move on to your number six for 2009.
My number six is a documentary, a British documentary, called Sleep Furiously.
And Penryn can't be found. So now I look forward to the day it's old and rusted and replaced with a wooden one. At least it could be trusted.
Ah, Welsh, Zan. You've gone all Welsh.
I've gone all Welsh. This is a documentary by Gideon Coppel, and it's about his hometown, I guess, Trefurig, which is a Welsh farming community. And it's where he grew up. It's where his family fled to from Nazi Germany. And this is an angry, tender elegy to a dying way of life. It's a film... I guess it's a film about Britain, and it's the real Britain that's under our nose and smelling of manure, but fading.
Sort of John Major's Britain, really.
It's not John Major's Britain. This is the Britain that would run John Major out on a rail if he went in there. It's not romanticised. It's not the cricket on the village green. This is a working environment, but it's a working environment that is dying. It's triggered by the closure of the local school, and it just looks at the all the machinations, the mechanisms that have sustained this way of life for centuries that are gradually falling away, and what's left after that.
There's a wonderful shot in it that is one of my shots of the year, is where the camera just sort of watches some sheep move across a hillside until there are none left. I think that's a brilliant metaphor for the way that the kind of that rural life is disappearing, but we have left a green remembered
hill. It sounds like a very grim documentary the way the way that I'm telling it, but it's visually beautiful. And you're right, there are the sheep, the lines of the sheep, there are a fascination with flapping sheets on a line.
Great music as well.
Music by Aphex Twin. And it's a wonderful film.
Well, having aped you, Zan, with my 7 and 8, I'm going to go for my number 6, which is Let the Right One In. It's been a year of the vampires. This one was the Swedish vampire movie by Thomas Alfredson. But, Zan, you've outbid me. It features on your list, slightly higher up, so we're not going to deal with it now. We're going to come to
Let's put it back in the cupboard.
Back in the cupboard. Let it resurrect itself when the sun comes down, when the sun goes down, for a bit later on. Now we're out of the lower half of the table. We reach for the high numbers in a minute, but we've got a competition for you first. We have a Le Donc and Scorsese pack up for grabs. You'll remember this is, of course, the mockumentary in which Shane Meadows followed his creation, Paddy Considine, around the country as they went up to Old Trafford's cricket ground to put on a gig for the Arctical Monkeys with his rapper Scorsese. I've got a mug here, a DVD, and a signed poster by the great man himself, Shane Meadows, to win. All you've got to do is listen to our montage of four directors who have all featured in my In the Director's Chair series this year, 2009. Give me the name of each director. It's that simple. Here you go. Who are these?
As you've grown larger in stature as the years have gone on, people forget the best film that year, according to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, Driving Miss Daisy, a film no one has seen, no one's watched.
Because you can feel that the place is at the vanguard of change, and the century that belonged to America, the last century, clearly belongs to Asia now. And one of the peaks or pinnacles or focus points of that will clearly be Mumbai.
And I think just the day in the life of a bomb tech in Baghdad at that time certainly is inherently dramatic. I mean, these are men who arguably have the most dangerous job in the world. They're walking toward what you and I and perhaps the rest of the world would run from.
I think sexuality, growing up as a Chinese person, it's something very much in the mind, like everybody in the world, but we don't have much communication. And as a dramatist, I just like that awkwardness.
And there you are. And the beauty of the podcast is that if you haven't got them, you can study the voices at your leisure. If you're stuck, go to guardian.co.uk. In the director's chair, and you'll find all of those directors plus many more. Sift through them and enter our competition. You have to do that by emailing before 5th of January. The email address to enter is film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. Zan, let's go on with the countdown as we enter our top fives of our films of 2009. Zan, your number five, please.
My number five, and we're into masterpiece territory now, I think, is Tony Manero.
Lui dice, io sono Tony Manero.
Zan, Tony Manero, wasn't he the guy played by John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever?
He was, and he's back. This is a Chilean pitch black comedy by Pablo Larraín. It stars Alfredo Castro as Raúl, who wants to dance as Tony Manero on a TV talent show, and he wears the white suit. He's a terrible dancer. He dances with a frowning, joyless concentration. He occasionally kills people as well. It's a very dark, unpleasant, slightly perplexing film. I saw this at Cannes in 2008 and really liked it, but couldn't quite get the measure of it. And then I saw it again when it was released here earlier this year and thought this is utterly brilliant.
Well, why is it, do you think, that the second viewing kind of helps? Because I'm in the same position as you. I think it's because it's so sort of perplexing and sort of genre-defying that you don't know where you are first time.
It sets itself up as a comedy, and then you get these kind of weird spasms of violence going on in the wings. You've got a character who's resolutely unsympathetic because he's just blank. I think that probably it's an acid satire on globalization. It's set in the 1970s. It's set in Pinochet-era Chile, where political talk can get you killed. And the populace is basically all brainwashed by these TV talent shows. But I guess on a wider level, it's about the Americanization of Latin America. And it is a story of a sort of zombie nation, where everybody is shambling around wearing clothes that don't fit them. And it is superb. It's nasty. It's not even especially funny, although it has some horrible moments of humour in it. And I was mesmerised by this.
Yeah, I suppose in a year that sort of towards the end has been dominated by reality TV shows and X Factor, etc. It's the obsession of some guy as well, wanting to be on telly and kind of win at all costs. I mean, it is wonderful. In fact, your inclusion of it so high up makes me feel slightly remiss that it's not on my list. I will see it again. And I love his dancing. I think it's so obsessively kind of murderous. It's sort of the dancing that Fred West might have done.
Yes, it really is. It's a great film.
That's number five. It's Tony Manero. My number five, Zan, is 35 Shots of Rum, a film by Claire Denis set in modern-day Paris. However, Zan, it features on your list too, slightly higher up yet again. Let's deal with it a bit later on. Let's move on then from 35 Shots of Rum at my number five to your number four.
My number four is The White Ribbon by Michael Haneke, but now you have outbid me. So we've getting a backlog of films that we need to discuss.
Well, we shall do in a minute, because at my number four is The Hurt Locker. It was your number 10, and it's my number four. So let's deal with Catherine Bigelow's The Hurt Locker.
Hot shit. You're a wild man, you know that?
Yes,
sir. He's a wild man, you know that? Why don't you shake your hand?
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. How many bombs?
We've touched on it before. It is the film that's sort of getting late Oscar pushes as well. We'll be talking about this much into 2010 as well, it seems. I think Catherine Bigelow is one of the really interesting filmmakers and has been for a very long time. I loved Blue Steel. I love Point Blank. I love what she does to the genre of masculinity.
Yes.
We had her on in the director's chair. We asked her about that, about why she's sort of so obsessed with male behaviour. And this film, I think, really gets to the nub of it as well. The kind of bravado, the machismo, the kind of the sort of having to sublimate your feelings of fear into a certain kind of job, doing your job well as well. That's what this is about, professionalism.
Yes, it is, and camaraderie. And you've got a great performance here from Jeremy Renner as the gung-ho bomb disposal expert who is basically endangering the lives of everybody else.
Weren't you just every time it was a car boot? I mean, I just was on, my fingers were like digging into the seat.
No, I mean, you know, the caveat with war films. I remember watching Hearts of Darkness, the film about Coppola making Apocalypse Now, and he said that making the film was like Vietnam. And the obvious response to that is, no, it wasn't. This is millionaire movie actors and movie directors wandering around struggling to make this movie. That's not like war. Having said that, I think that The Hurt Locker does come closer than almost any other film to capturing just that sweaty-palmed, claustrophobic tension of what it must be like to be doing a job like that.
And I loved Jeremy Renner in it, but I also loved the supporting performance by Anthony Mackie as his kind of the guy who he was endangering every time. And this was a movie that people got to shout a lot into walkie-talkies and kind of use that jargon, that kind of soldier's jargon. And I have to say that it kind of completely won me over, every single bit of it.
It's a superbly manufactured film.
And artistic as well. I mean, one of the images of the year was that the bombs that he discovers when he can, and you see it almost beautifully arranged, like an artistic installation. Yeah. You could see, you know, someone doing it, Mark Wallinger or something, doing this kind of thing of bombs.
That's
kind of
the Turner Prize next year.
Yeah, maybe sorted. Bigelow at number four, your number 10, my number four, The Hurt Locker. Let's move up to number three, Zan. I have a feeling you're going to be controversial here.
I'm shocked, Jason, that this isn't on your list anywhere. My number three is Lars von Trier's Antichrist.
Chaos reigns.
That's a fox from Antichrist. There's Ant. Why is a talking fox in this film?
Why not? I think there should be more films with talking foxes. If it's this and The Fantastic Mr. Fox, it's been a good year for the talking fox.
You say your surprise is not on my list. It is on my list, Zan. It's on my top turkey of 2009.
I think that's outrageous. I loved this, and I'm sticking with it through thick and thin. I loved it because it went for it. This is a master director risking everything, pretty much, daring to push himself, daring to push his actors, daring to push the audience beyond the limits.
Yeah, daring beyond the limits.
Well, this is it, daring to be risible. And I think a lot of the times this film is risible. It's on the verge of complete meltdown. It's almost less a film than a voodoo spell, really, that you fall under and it rattles you up.
Take us back to the controversy. Obviously, it was I've called it the single most shocking shot ever shown in Cannes Film Festival. It then had this kind of run of controversy, played at Edinburgh, came out. People probably remember what it is, but just fill us in what on earth Antichrist's about.
Well, Antichrist is Charlotte Gainsbourg and Willem Dafoe as a bereaved couple who retreat to their cottage in the woods to get over the death of their son, where Charlotte Gainsbourg proceeds to go clean off the rails, and in TM, the trademark, the most shocking scene ever played in Cannes, she subjects herself to a clitorectomy, which you see in gaudy full-screen detail. It's a deliberately shocking, provocative film. I'm not sure its intentions are pure in any way, shape or form. And when it played in Cannes, people were booing. There was a lot of laughter. But I think it's kind of almost self-defensive laughter. It's easier to laugh off a film like this than go with it.
Yeah, I agree. I think as much of it is beautiful as well. That's the kind of part of the problem I have with it. It is so beautiful, Anthony Dodd-Mantle's cinematography.
Yeah. There's been so much writing about this film that it's almost lets too much light into it. It works at its best when it jumps out and ambushes you.
My colleague Philip French on The Observer, of course, it was his number four film of 2009.
Good on Philip.
Yes, he liked it. But it reminded him of Bergman. I think it was set in Sweden. Things with horses in the riding of westerns and things set in Sweden, they didn't really get
Mad women.
Mad women. I did like Charlotte Gainsbourg in there. She's a friend of yours, obviously.
She is very close.
Your number three was Antichrist. My number three, Zan, was your number four. It is Michael Haneke's The White Ribbon.
Wo auch Gottes Gebot heilige Schranken errichtet hat. Der Knabe ahmte diese Handlung nach und konnte nicht mehr damit aufhören.
This, I think, we described when it came out as the perfect film. Zan, it won at Cannes, the same Cannes at which your Antichrist showed. It is a provocative film as well. I think Haneke is an arch provocateur in the way that Lars von Trier is. Just, I tend to agree with him slightly more. It's unsettling, it's provocative. It's set in a German town where strange things are happening to the children, or perhaps by the children. I think Hidden, Michael Haneke's film, if we were doing a review of the decade, would be my film of the decade.
Really?
So it's I think what he does with art and where we are now and examining things, even though he set The White Ribbon in 1913, it kind of, its ramifications ripple way beyond its kind of historical confines.
I think you're right. You know, we're drawing all these parallels between these films on the list, and I guess that the odd parallel that I draw with The White Ribbon is actually to Sleep Furiously, which again is about a rural community that's dying out. Haneke plays it differently, and the suggestion is that good You know, this community should die out. It's a fairly unpleasant feudal environment. It looks beautiful. It's a pastoral, but it's an anti-pastoral that he conjures up.
The people who rule this society are the baron and the teacher and the pastor, who rules it with a sort of iron kind of will. I don't know, Lutheranism, some sort of strain of kind of very preventative Christianity, where his young son, who's started to masturbate, gets his hands tied to the bed so that he does not pleasure himself.
Yeah, that happened to us all. It's just part of growing up.
It is. But no wonder they slightly turn on these people. I thought it was an absolutely stunning film to watch. I mean, as a piece of art, to see it on a big screen, it was like watching an installation. Christian Berger's cinematography, I noted, was the New York critics picked that as the cinematography. The crispness of it is almost what makes it so frightening, its clarity.
You're right. And when we describe it as the perfect film, I think we mean perfect in that it's perfectly composed, perfectly scripted, does not put a foot wrong, even though it's willfully opaque. You've got these mysterious crimes being committed, and you're never entirely 100% sure. You're never told explicitly who is committing them. But there's the sense that it's a film that ends in the run-up to the First World War, but it foreshadows the Second World War, and there's the sense that Germany is incubating monsters in this idyllic rural environment.
Yeah, and not just Germany as well. I like to think that it's...
Everybody.
I like to think. I don't really like to think about it, but it's sort of all society that does this, that kind of applies some kind of moral code and pressure on it. Will the sins of the fathers will be visited on the sons and then visited on the rest of us. Zan, let's move up to your number two.
My number two is Claire Denis's 35 Shots of Rum.
Zan, it was my number five. Let's talk about it now as your number two. 35 Shots of Rum. It's kind of like the Cool Hand Luke when he eats 50 eggs. Could you do 35 Shots of Rum again?
That's an average Friday night for me. And then I will do the 35 Shots of Rum, and then I will watch 35 Shots of Rum.
Why do we love this film so much, you and I?
I think it's warm and it's real. It's a film about the lives of people that you can utterly believe existing. And in that way, it's full of mystery. It introduces you to these people. You get to know them very well, and yet there are dark pockets. There are enigmatic moments to it.
Who are these people?
These people are Alex Discasse, who is a widower, a train driver, who lives with his daughter, played by Mati Diop. And it's their neighbour who once had an affair with the train driver, and the moody upstairs neighbour who fancies the daughter a bit, but you're never entirely sure. And it is just a beautiful portrait of life and a particular slice of working class French life.
This being Claire Denis as well, it's all elliptical as well. As you say, you're never quite sure. I mean, I think it takes 10, 20 minutes before you're aware that she's even his daughter. You're not sure that...
Because their relationship is so tender.
Yeah, I mean, it's from the first shot, this film of Claire Denis, I was completely taken into this world, this kind of lower sort of social housing in Paris kind of world, like an advent calendar. We see the building and the lives they're in, and they just grow on you. And I thought the music was superb, the performances were superb, the way of telling this almost soapy story was just delicious.
And there's a beautiful scene in there where they're driving home, and I think their car breaks down, it's raining, and they take refuge in a cafe, and it becomes this sort of accidental coming together, which I think is maybe the point of the whole film.
I'd have to say they're listening to the radio to a Sonia George track, and I went out and bought a Sonia George album as a result of listening to this. And it also has a wonderful scene where they're all stranded in a cafe straight after that. And they're eating, and then they play the Night Shift, of course, by the Commodores, which comes on really a naff 80s anthem, to go back to your
original. But it becomes ennobled through this film.
Absolutely, the most glorious, glorious piece of music ever. Zan, that's your number two, 35 Shots of Rum, and a worthy high spot for that in both of our lists. My number two, I'm going to raise your kind of soulful look at Paris life to a soulful look at a concert. It's the concert that surrounded the rumble in the jungle in Kinshasa in 1974 in Zaire. It was a concert that went ahead, even though the flight was delayed. It is Soul Power.
What we left here with, plus the influences that we picked up from living where we've lived for the last 300-400 years or whatever, you know.
Right.
So we're coming back now in the same form, but with other places on it. Meanwhile, they've evolved from
Zan, this is a documentary that has been hidden since the 70s. It was never used. Bits of it came up in the documentary When We Were Kings, but it was actually in the vault, and then it was restored. And for its technical ability to restore a film and give it a digital transformation and kind of piece together hundreds of hours of footage by cinematographers, including the Maisels brothers, I thought this was just a sort of a brilliant kind of found piece of footage that has become and lives anew, and about kind of James Brown and Bill Withers and B.B. King, whom we heard there. They are rediscovering Africa, and Ali is in it, who's one of my favourite icons of all time. I just would watch this endlessly, really.
Well, you describe it as a found bit of footage. It hasn't actually been found by me yet.
Ah.
And so, shamefully, I have to admit that I have not seen your number two, which I think happened last year with Couscous, which was your number one then, which I, at the time, I hadn't seen. Saw it afterwards and thought it was marvellous. So I'm looking forward to seeing.
I think you sort of have to be into the music a bit.
I am, kind of, yeah.
Yeah, it's very, very funky.
I mean, it's not Husker Du, but no, I'll certainly go with it.
I mean, James Brown is just fantastic, and it's a great performance by him. But B.B. King is good, Bill Withers is good, Celia Cruz is good, there are some African dancers, Miriam McCabe doing a click song. It's just great, and it has all this kind of colonial aspect to it, very subtly done. It's not a documentary, which I love about it, in which talking heads come in and Norman Mailer says, yeah, well, I was there, or anyone kind of does that. It just sort of tells it how it was, and there's this wonderful plane journey where all the Americans kind of leave town and Don King's kind of on board and James Brown's at the front and everyone's drunk at the back and they're on this plane that's overloaded with luggage and it could go down. It's a miracle it even takes off in the first place. And there they are, just kind of, it's chaos on board. I mean, it is just, if you were an EasyJet stewardess, you would have a fit throwing hot soup over all of these people. Just delicious memories of Soul Power. It's out on DVD, re-released by Eureka this year, and it's kind of lodged in my heart as a piece of favourite there. So number two on my list.
Okay, I'll check it out.
Check it out. We come now, Zan, to the number ones, the films that grab us and stay with us throughout 2010. And I think as we're doing our list, Zan, we've chosen films that their sort of status as good films is, you know, being argued by us. And I think none of us have sort of said to us, what is that doing on your list, apart from Antichrist, which obviously is well made. However, when we come to look at these, they're films that stay with you, aren't they? They're films there, the ones that are personal favourites we get to stretch out here. So your personal favourite of 2009, your number one film is?
My number one film is Let the Right One In.
The vampires had it big this year. You've got your teeth in to Let the Right One In.
Well, it was either this or Twilight, and I went with this. I don't even see this as a vampire film, necessarily.
Yeah, absolutely right.
I think of all the films on this list that I love to bits, I think that this is the one that kind of moved me the most. It's a haunting film. It's a strange film. It's a coming-of-age tale again. But I think, most of all, it's a film about the burdens of love. And it's a film about two kids who find each other. And I guess the key thing is that when you find someone, when you find anyone, you are taking on their baggage. And that is what happens in this film. They both help each other, and it has a very enigmatic ending that isn't entirely happy. There's a lot of pain involved in this decision that they make.
It's a film about a kid at school being bullied and then sort of kind of meeting a kind of rather kind of withdrawn neighbour.
Who is the little vampire girl who lives in the next flat. What it does with vampirism, I don't want to say that there's nothing to do with vampirism in this film at all, but it basically shows the vampire lifestyle. It draws parallels between the other people on this really grotty 1980s Swedish housing estate. And vampirism is kind of, it's akin to alcoholism. There's a lot of alcoholics who live there. And these are people who live on the margins of society. So it's a very humane, poignant film about people who don't fit in for whatever reason.
And I love the setting for Sweden as almost a vampire heaven, really. It's dark half the year.
Exactly, dark place. And snowy.
Yes, and I mean, so I love that kind of almost the social realist aspect of Thomas Alfredson's work there, the kind of novelty value. It's also a high school movie, which I really like about it. You say she's the vampire that lives in, so we're never sure, are we? We're not straight away sure that she's a vampire.
We're not straight away sure that she's a vampire.
Or even she's a she.
Or that she's a she, or even who the man is who is looking after her. Is he her father, or is he perhaps a lover who has grown old while she stayed young? And then that has interesting implications for the character of Oscar, who's the boy who pals up with her. Because is he then going to become the sad old man who's basically going around trying to find victims for her?
It's a
small film, but it contains almost everything.
Of all the films on our list that we talk about seeing again, and you'd want to see most of these again, Let the Right One In merits a second viewing as well.
I've seen it twice now, and it's better the second time.
Absolutely. That is a proof of a good film, and that's why it's your number one. It was my number six and your number one. I'd happily concur with you, at least not to incur the wrath of any vampires who might be lurking, because the world is full of them.
But right this shows them to be kind of nice people too.
Yeah, but I don't want to be put in a box and groomed as a feeder for the rest of my life. I'm going Jewish for my number ones, and if I don't pick this film as number one, who will? I'm going for the Coen brothers, A Serious Man.
Move out.
Well, it makes eminent sense.
Things can't continue, is it?
Move out. Where would I go?
Well, for instance, the Jolly Roger is quite livable. It's not expensive. The rooms are eminently habitable.
This would allow you to visit the
This case. Was the only film this year, the story of Michael Stuhlbarg's Larry, who in the run-up to his son's bar mitzvah is having a crisis of confidence at work. His wife is leaving him for Cy Abelman, and he is trying to become a good Jewish man. He wants to be a serious man. He's having trouble from all sides, tsuris, to use the Yiddish term. And this was the film, as soon as it ended, it was the only film this year, as soon as it ended, I wanted to stay like an old-fashioned kind of repertory theatre. I want to stay in there and watch it again.
You're hoping that there are some bloopers at the end.
Yeah, the outtakes. When a little voiceover squirrel comes in. I did think this was it was the Coen brothers kind of going back to their Minnesota childhood, their kind of bar mitzvah era. I've always admired the Coen brothers. Sometimes I love them more than not, and this one I thought was their warmest, most personal film to date. That said, so many people have come up to me afterwards and said, those Coens, they've got no heart. And I thought this was warm and tender examination of a community and its kind of fragile relationship with religion. But so many people have said to me, oh, they're cruel people.
Well, I think I would be with those people. I think this wasn't a particularly warm film. I think maybe it is a personal film. I thought it was brilliantly made. I was utterly gripped by it throughout. I thought it was a superb piece of work. I don't think it was warm.
Maybe it's their relationship with religion that it's a secular relationship that one's forced into this tradition, and that's why it starts with this Yiddish parable, which almost
I love that,
which is just great. You almost don't. I mean, if it was just that on its own, that would have won awards for me as the best short. This kind of story about the Dibbuk who haunts this kind of family and uses Yiddish. I just thought this, and then it has this wonderful image of the guy of Larry going up on the roof and fiddling with his sort of aerial so that his son can get the fiddler on the roof kind of analogy and the connection, I thought was just delicious. I've always been surprised that so many non-Jews have come up to me and sort of said they loved the film as well. So in fact, the Jews themselves have got a sort of strange relationship.
Well, that is interesting, yeah. And I loved, you mentioned the character of Cy Abelman. I thought that he was one of the great movie monsters of the year in a way. This mellifluous, sort of charming, oily presence who basically is a total opportunist, but in the guise of helping, is wonderful.
I think it's a seriously, seriously good movie. I hope Michael Stuhlbarg gets an Oscar nomination for it. And the Coens will probably, it's not what, you know, they won Best Film for No Country.
Yeah.
It'll probably be sort of a screenplay nomination. That's what they do with people. They're not quite sure what to do with it. But I thought the writing was just superb. So my number one film of 2009 is A Serious Man. Yours is Let the Right One In. Do go and seek them both out. So to sum up, Zan, do you think 2010... can match up to that?
Of course it can. We have to think that. If we didn't think that, we may as well just pack it in now. 2009 was great, but 2010 will be even better.
Ah, the eternal optimist, critic of cinema. Zan, I'm with you. We have to keep on going, because if we don't, we see these things so that you don't have to. Zan Brooks, thank you very much for joining me throughout the year. It's been a pleasure sharing it with you. I look forward to sharing 2010 with you. And I thank all our guests on Film Weekly throughout the year. Thanks to you as well, dear listeners. Hope you're having a great festive break. At least on triple time if you're working. But until the new year, from me, Jason Solomons, and Film Weekly's producer, Jason Phipps, it's Happy Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and a very Happy New Year. Goodbye.